from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, with just 4 days left until Election Day, there's a lot of emphasis on what the polls are saying. The latest New York Times CBS News poll shows 45% of likely voters supporting Hillary Clinton and 42% supporting Donald Trump. But other polls show a much tighter race. What explains the difference in results? And after some recent high-profile fails, like Brexit, can polls continue to be trusted? We look at the science of polling and what's been behind the wild swings in the numbers during this presidential election. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. If you've looked at polls during this presidential election to get a sense of where voters stand on the candidates, you likely found it a roller coaster ride. This year, the polls have shifted wildly on a near weekly basis, frequently after big news events. But with two such different candidates, are voters really changing their minds this much? In this hour of Forum, we look at what's behind the big swings in polling numbers, the apparent tightening of the presidential race, and bigger issues facing the polling industry that might make it harder to get accurate numbers. And let me tell you who is joining us. Henry Brady is Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Good morning, Henry Brady.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to John Cohen, who's with me in studio. He's Senior Vice President of Survey Research and Chief Research Officer at SurveyMonkey. Good morning, John Cohen.
Good morning.
And good morning to you, Ron Elving, Senior Editor and Correspondent on the Washington Desk at NPR News.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Ron, I want to start with you, if I could. As we've been hearing from pollsters, polls typically tighten at this time. Can you tell us if it's more than usual?
It does seem to be a bit more dramatic than usual for the simple reason that Hillary Clinton had opened a commanding lead just a couple of weeks ago. And in the aftermath of the third and final debate, she seemed to be completely in control of the race. And the debate was over how far her landslide, as some people were calling it, might spread, including states such as Georgia and Arizona, even closing up in Texas. But then, of course, a week ago today, we had a rather large bombshell from James Comey, the FBI director, saying almost casually in a three-paragraph letter to Republicans on Capitol Hill that they were going to look at some more emails that they'd found on a computer and that some of these might be of interest, but they didn't really know, and they might be insignificant, but they just wanted to let the Republicans on Capitol Hill know. All right, that's a big story. Obviously, it has changed the focus. Instead of everyone talking about Donald Trump most of the time and his faults, now it's been Hillary Clinton at the bottom of the rain barrel for 1 week. And that was seen to put a thumb on the scales a little bit, especially at a time when the natural closing up of the gap between the two candidates was taking place. Donald Trump had fallen quite low, well below 40 in many polls, and he was going to come back up at some juncture. The polls were going to close naturally, as we've said, and that was accelerated and perhaps exaggerated by the Comey effect.
John Cohen, is this true in terms of the numbers that you're seeing? Has the race done its natural tightening or even maybe a little more because of these recent bombshells?
In some ways it has. I would point out, however, the shifts in the storylines have been far more dramatic than the shifts in voter opinions. You know, voter opinions have been relatively stable over the course of the entire fall, you know, despite, you know, three, you know, fierce presidential debates and a vice presidential debate. You know, we've had, and if you look at the polling averages, we've had a lot of consistency nationally and also in the states. What's changed, though, is the storyline. As Ron mentions, it is true that when the focus is on either one of these candidates, it doesn't help that person. We are facing a historic situation where both candidates face unfavorable numbers that haven't been seen before. You know, well over 60% have unfavorable ratings of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and a quarter of all voters dislike both of them. So when the focus is on one of those candidates, that candidate does, you know, tend to dip a little bit. But most of it's just the natural narrowing that we see. And it's just a change of focus, as Ron mentioned, from thinking about Georgia, Texas, and Arizona to whether, you know, Clinton can prevail in Michigan, Wisconsin, and ultimately North Carolina.
Well, before we get into more of the dynamics of the particular race in terms of what the polls are actually telling us about their status, these two candidates' status in particular states, I guess one of the questions I have is, you're saying that it hasn't, voter attitudes haven't necessarily changed that much, but then why do we see wild swings, John Cohen, after a big news event?
Well, so in some cases we haven't. So an example, for example, in our polling, and we've been doing polling with NBC News all year, releasing every week, and we've started a 50-state tracking poll where we release every day. We just haven't seen dramatic movements despite events. Part of the reason we haven't seen movements, and I would say the averages also haven't moved that much, is because so much is in the eyes of the beholders. In all presidential campaigns, particularly in this one with such fierce partisanship at stake. When the Trump tape came out, for instance, overwhelmingly it was nearly universal among Trump voters to call that a distraction, not a major issue to discuss. Similarly, overwhelmingly, Clinton voters see the FBI's coming out on Friday, reopening the email probe as a distraction to the campaign, not a major issue. So things change really on the margins.
Well, if things change really on the margins, I guess one of the reasons that it feels like a wild swing is just as an example, Ron Elving, right, if you were following, say, 538 and you saw a couple weeks ago, you know, Clinton was in the 80%, you know, percentiles for potentially winning this race. Now she's dipped below 70%. Is that not a wild swing that has something to do with the dynamics in this particular race, Ron Elving?
Let's look at the word wild. Any swing at all in the direction of Donald Trump is going to change the 538 calculation. Of course, this is Nate Silver's famous calculation. He has an algorithm. He runs many polls through it. He also does versions where he sweetens the analysis a little bit by going beyond the polls. And his number had reached the high 80s. I think it might have touched 90 at some point or another in that period of time when Donald Trump's campaign appeared to be in free fall. Since then, Donald Trump has been putting together a more coherent message. He's been staying largely out of the news. He's been reading speeches off of a teleprompter, and he's letting other people do his campaign ads so that we don't see Donald Trump till the end when he says, "I approve this message." All of those things are good for the Donald Trump numbers. But probably the most important thing is that all of these polls are measuring sentiment at a particular moment in time, and there can be fluctuations at the margin, very small fluctuations that involve an extraordinarily small number of people who may have said they were undecided or who may have actually changed their minds. And that number then run through the polling science and then, most importantly, reported in a particular way by some pollsters and by many journalists, takes it from being a swing to what you could call a wild swing. And you see something like the ABC Washington Post tracking poll where Hillary Clinton has a double-digit lead, and then even before the Comey letter, she had dropped back down to low single digits, and since then it's been bumping around in the low single digits to tie range. And that looks like a wild swing, but it may not actually be measuring that much of a real change.
I see. Henry Brady of the Goldman School at UC Berkeley, I'm curious what you make of folks who say that the high unfavorability ratings of both of these candidates has contributed somewhat to swings, I'll put it, or, you know, shifts in voter sentiment over the course of this particular campaign.
Yeah, I think that it's really just a simple thing that when you're choosing between two things you have clear opinions about, one you like and one you dislike, then it's sort of easy to constantly say, okay, I like this one, I dislike that one. Now, when you have a situation where you have two things you dislike, especially for independents who are really responsible for a lot of the volatility in the polls, these are people not that attentive to politics by and large who are just coming into a cognizance, really, that the election is soon and I better figure out how I'm going to vote. Those folks are subject to the notion that there's just two candidates who aren't really very likable, and it's really hard to choose which you like or will choose in the end when they have such high unfavorables. So as a result, I think those voters are easily swung one direction or another. As everybody's been saying, when attention is on one candidate, that typically means it's bad news, and that person then loses support in the polls. And I think that's what's going on to a large degree.
Well, John Cohen, can you explain what non-response bias is? Because that's come up a lot. And whether or not you feel like it's been a big factor this time around, as some have suggested.
Right. So we're talking about voters potentially shifting opinion. I think more appropriate when you're looking at polling is, are certain voters no longer responding to surveys? And does that happen in particular moments with, you know, real consequences for how we see the polls?
So, for example, if their particular candidate has a bad news cycle, something right. bad comes out about them, like a tape if your candidate is Trump, or the emails if your candidate is Hillary Clinton, you're less willing to talk with pollsters?
Exactly. One of the clearest and most well-researched examples of this actually happened in 2012. So after the first presidential debate where President Obama, by his own admission, performed horribly, what happened afterwards where the polls showed a really major swing to to Mitt Romney at the time, including in the Pew poll, I think swung by 11 points on the margin, you know, just after the first presidential debate. What it turned out is that it wasn't because there was a major change in how people perceived those two candidates or how they planned to vote. It was just Democrats were as down as the president himself turned out to be, and they stopped picking up their telephones.
But how real is this in this particular election, do you think? I mean, do you think this is explaining the exaggeration that, you know, if your numbers are relatively stable, then some exaggerations in polling, I guess, would be a good way
to characterize it. I certainly think so. So Ron mentioned earlier the Washington Post ABC News poll. And you know, what that poll showed was a major drop in enthusiasm among Clinton supporters over, you know, the course of the weekend. So although the narrowing, as Ron mentioned, happened prior to the Friday announcement, it continued through the weekend. And that drop in enthusiasm, which the poll showed, may have mirrored one with, you know, other Democrats not answering the poll.
Well, I guess we've talked a lot about there not being these big fluctuations that we're seeing, swings more on the margins. So what does that ultimately mean? I mean, who do you think is going to win? Is it still relatively the way it's been looking all year with Clinton with a relatively narrow lead, but a steady one throughout?
She's had a steady advantage. So in our ongoing surveys, she's had a 5 to 7 point national lead the entire fall, despite all these, you know, small ups and downs and large ones that have been picked up in other polls. And she has the inside track on the Electoral College as well. I mean, you know, let's think back to 2012. In 2012 was widely thought to be the last election the Republican Party could win if it was a 90% white party. 90% of white voters, you know, kind of the votes for Mitt Romney were 90% white. And that was the last time they thought they could win. So they're at a structural disadvantage given the continued demographic changes in this country. And so they're at a disadvantage again in 2016. It's just there's so much disquiet in the country and so much anxiety in part left over from the Great Recession and the, you know, inroads that the white voters have not made to recover from that, that there's still some question here, but there's no question that Hillary Clinton has the inside track on next week.
Henry Brady, do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. I think it's also very important to remember that Hillary Clinton started with a disadvantage, and that is that the fundamentals are against her. When you've had an incumbent president of a particular party for two terms, as we've had with Barack Obama, people are tired of the incumbent party. They don't necessarily want a successor. And so you've overcome a big mountain to climb, and that's what she's had to do. In addition, the economic issues, the growth has not been as much as what usually can be helpful in terms of winning an election. So there was a good jobs report today. There was a fair number of jobs, and unemployment actually is low, but growth has not been that great. Although actually today there was a report that wage growth was at about 2.8%. Now, if that had been going on for the last year, at this point that would have helped Hillary Clinton a lot. But unfortunately for her, it's just being reported now and in other recent reports. So she's had to overcome an economic situation that wasn't so good for her and the two-term of Barack Obama that she's trying to succeed him as a Democrat.
Okay, but this conversation is probably helping Hillary Clinton supporters feel maybe a little bit better right now. But then there's always this question, or it's been looming even more, it feels like, especially after the Brexit vote, of whether or not the polls can be trusted. Because during the lead-up to the Brexit vote, of course, where Britons got to vote about whether or not they would leave the European Union, polls suggested, I believe it was like a 52-48% margin that folks would vote to remain with the European Union. So, Henry Brady, do you think that we could be having a Brexit effect here, where in fact that lead that she has, which is, you know, relatively within what, 4 percentage points on average, right? That it might not actually be accurate.
Yeah, well, that's of course possible. But the truth is, we have so many polling firms out there doing it, sampling in so many different ways, asking questions in so many different ways, and actually estimating likely voters in so many different ways. When all of them, by and large, point in the same direction, you start thinking that it's hard to believe everybody is getting it wrong. And the few outliers we can typically explain in terms of the nature of the polling methods they're using. So it seems to me that it's unlikely we're at a Brexit moment. And as you say, the Brexit polling showed that Brexit that the support for Remain was actually stronger than the support for Leave by maybe 2 or 3 percentage points. And that, of course, would make a big difference if the swing in the current polls was 2 or 3 percentage points. But actually, what that would probably do is actually mean that it was essentially a tie right now. That would still probably mean that Hillary Clinton was advantaged given the nature of the Electoral College situation that she faces. So it's really hard to believe that the polls in the end are going to be wrong here. It's always a possibility, but I think it's highly unlikely.
One of the things that Henry Brady brings up, John Cohen, is the importance of having lots of polls, right, and see how what direction they're all pointing in. But hasn't one of the challenges been this year that there are fewer polling agencies putting out quality polls? I've read that there was a dip, say, from, in 2012 at this time in the election, say when you were about 10 days out, that there were like 90 polls being conducted. And this time around, there were, you know, less than or right around 35, less than 40.
For me, it's less about the number of polls that are out there than the quality of the polls that are out there and the variety.
Are they high quality?
And the variety of methods that are being used. And as Henry pointed out, you know, regardless of the variety of the methods that are currently being used, they all point generally in the same direction. I do want to make one point about Brexit, if I can, because also Brexit was a single national vote that came down to effectively a coin flip. Which, you know, coin flips, you know, pollsters can get one way or the other. Well, the situation we're facing here is that for Donald Trump to win the way Leave won in Britain, he would have to win 5 or 6 coin flips, you know, all of them, right? Because we're talking about coin flips in Wisconsin, you know, Michigan, Florida, there are 5 or 6 states that he would have to win all of. So it would be a far more consequential failure if, in fact, Brexit was a polling failure, but we can debate that another time.
But Ron Elving, how much of an effect does fewer polling places or, you know, entities that do quality polling have? I had read that having fewer of them, right, creates more swings, right? If you have more to average out, right, you'll have probably an average that's a little bit better than if you have a fewer number of polls to go by.
You know, if you sit down and look at Real Clear Politics polling average or Huffington Post's polling average or 270 to Win or any of the other websites that aggregate polls, it's hard to believe we have a paucity or a poverty of polling. It seems that we have many people in the field. And while not all of them have the same ends, not all of them have the same objectives, most all of them want to be right, and they want to look right on the day of the election or the day after. So it seems here that it is not so much a quality of having, you know, not so much a question, rather, of having enough polls to aggregate and get an accurate number. It's much more a question of trying to get a handle on who's a voter and who is actually responding on telephone or online. And we do get some variety in the results, depending on whether the phone is a landline or a cell phone, or whether it's conducted, the interview is conducted online. So there are some of those variations in there. But the only thing I would add to the Brexit discussion would be that one of the things that seems to have happened in Great Britain was that a number of people were so sure and so reassured by the polls that Brexit was going to fail and that Remain would prevail that they didn't vote. And there were quite a number of people who were quite stunned when they learned that their vote might have actually mattered. Now, this has always been a concern for the Democratic, for the Hillary Clinton campaign all fall, that they would get so far ahead and the polls would say this over and over, and that the lead would seem insurmountable, as it indeed did a couple of weeks ago, and that a lot of their folks would just take a pass, just not want to go to the trouble. And in some places and in some circumstances, it's real trouble to go vote.
Well, you raise a really important point about the media's effect on voters and even its coverage of polling, right, on voters. I mean, how influenced are voters by the polls, Henry Brady?
And how I don't think they're that much affected, actually, by the polls, especially in this election where they have strong opinions about the candidates, typically. I think in primaries they may matter more because people look at the primary and say, well, X is way ahead and therefore I don't need to go vote, and it's a nuisance anyway. But I think in a presidential election like this at this point, I don't think the polls are influencing people's votes that much one way or another.
Or how they're covered by the media in terms of extending, say, for example, a bad news event for maximum viewership or listenership or readership.
Certainly the media has had a big impact, and to the degree they use polls as part of that media coverage, that probably has been important. I think we've seen an especially intense period with respect to each candidate again and again and again, where the media seemed to focus on one issue for that candidate, and that has some impact on what the polls look like, and then another issue, and that has some impact. I still actually don't think that if you really look at the polling data, that those effects have been all that big. They've been more in the 1-2% at most kind of impacts, and given that Hillary Clinton right now is 1-3% ahead in the aggregation of polls, that's probably not going to matter that much in the end.
John Cohen, Ron Elving raised some interesting points about cell phones, right? How much of a shift or how much work has it been for you as a pollster, as an entity that's trying to reach people, the growth in the use of cell phones? How has it changed how you approach
survey? In my current purchase, SurveyMonkey, it doesn't affect it at all. We are online entirely, and we can talk about the methodology there.
Yeah.
But in my previous roles at ABC News, and I ran polling at the Washington Post for the last two presidential cycles, and then at the Pew Research Center, mobile phones have dramatically transformed the industry. I mean, we're talking about half of American adults don't have a landline anymore. When you talk about younger voters, it's off the charts in terms of being cell-only, as pollsters call them. It was a huge challenge, both methodologically, but more financially. You know, kind of high quality telephone polling has become a luxury item. And, you know, from my perspective, that's a shame. We're talking here about horse race polling, but polling is, of course, used for understanding our political system, understanding a lot more than just who's going to win or who's positioned to win. And so that's a real challenge, that approach to polling has become cost prohibitive for so many use cases.
And why has it gotten so expensive? Do you have to spend a lot more time trying to find real live people when you're dialing cell phone numbers?
Absolutely. So one is federal law requires that a call center hand dial a number that they know to be a cell phone number. So instead of using automating a dialer, they have to actually have someone, you know, kind of dial that number by hand, and that's costly. So that's one factor. You know, the other factor is just that with the change, people are less apt to pick up their cell phone from an unknown number than they might have been once upon a time sitting at home during dinner. There was one study that came out recently that said it took 300 calls to reach a single Hispanic young male voter.
Wow.
So that's a tremendous amount of effort, and if you're hand dialing all the time, that just skyrockets the cost.
We're talking with John Cohen, Senior Vice President of Survey Research and Chief Research Officer at SurveyMonkey. We're also talking with Ron Elving, Senior Editor and Correspondent on the Washington Desk at NPR News, and Henry Brady, Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at UC Berkeley. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum at kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook and Twitter. We want to know what your questions are about polling. Do you find them helpful in understanding the dynamics of an election, or just confusing? How much stock do you put into polls? Join us after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at the science of polling and what's been behind the wild swings in the numbers during this presidential election. We're also talking about bigger issues facing the polling industry that make it harder to get accurate numbers. And we're joined by Henry Brady, Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at UC Berkeley, John Cohen, Senior Vice President of Survey Research and Chief Research Officer at SurveyMonkey, and Ron Elving, Senior Editor and Correspondent on the Washington Desk at NPR. NPR News. And we're also joined by you, our listeners. Let me read what they have to say. Roy tweets, Brexit was a straight in or out vote. The Electoral College is completely different. And actually, we will be talking about the Electoral College on Monday with Michael Krasny. And Paul writes, I hope that KQED and other news organizations will provide an honest assessment and critical review of the major polling sources after the election. My concern is that the polling is self-serving to make headlines and keep pollsters in the news. A post-review would help legitimize or delegitimize these so-called experts. John Cohen, before the break, you were mentioning how hard it was, say, for example, to get a Hispanic voter. I mean, you're trying to get a good sample size, right? Whether it's broken down by gender, race, income. How hard has that become? It sounds like the challenges have increased dramatically in the last decade.
Well, certainly in the telephone polling, which has been the gold standard for decades, has become increasingly difficult. When Pew has done several major studies over the last decade that show response rates declining rather dramatically from, you know, 40 to 30 to all the way down to 9% in the big study they did in 2012. And that was in 2012. You know, the technological trends that drove that response rate down over the course of several decades have just continued since 2012 and kind of increased dramatically among certain populations. So that approach, you know, has, you know, kind of gotten even more clumsy. You know, still works extremely well, but is, as I mentioned in the previous segment, just prohibitively expensive for most use cases. Those are just more and more you have to make adjustments to numbers when you're kind of getting response rates that are in the low single digits. And then the internet has come as a potential replacement, you know, to the telephone methodologies. And for 15 years, most of those approaches have been about empaneling groups of people to take surveys for some form of compensation. And then there are new approaches, including ours at SurveyMonkey, that rely on, you know, lots of responses being out there and making sure that they have sufficient diversity and then making methodologically rigorous and then ultimately transparent adjustments to those and then presenting those to the world.
Henry Brady, has there been a decline in people's willingness to respond to polls? And if so, what do you think is behind it?
Well, yeah, I think there is, and I think it's partly just because polling is old hat. That's one thing. I think also the fact people don't want to be bothered. They lead very busy lives. But let me say something about the difficulty of getting good samples these days. We're really at a turning point in polling. We know how to get good telephone samples, even with cell phones. We know how to do that, although it's difficult, as John Cohen says. We actually don't know that much about how to really get a good sample on the internet. And indeed, there's a lot of concerns with some of the methodologies out there that impanel people and who is actually being impaneled on the internet. Obviously, some people don't even have the internet, so it may be hard to even impanel them to begin with. And then there's the problems that you end up maybe with very small numbers of people, and then you use those people to represent lots of people in the population because you just simply couldn't contact or impanel enough of those kinds of people. And the net result sometimes can be real volatility within subgroups because you get somebody who's really not that representative of that particular subgroup. And so I think all of us are trying very hard to figure out what is the best way to come up with a good way to do internet sampling, and I don't think we have the model yet. This, by the way, may mean, for example, that one of the things we're going to find in the assessment after the election is that we haven't done a good job, for example, of getting good representatives of the Hispanic community. And that community is going to matter a lot in at least three crucial states, Arizona, Florida, and Nevada.
Online polling has become more popular because it's cheaper, right, John Cohen? More polling entities. I'm not necessarily saying that SurveyMonkey is doing that because
it's a real question. I mean, I think in some part that's true. I think the larger part and the bigger mission and the bigger challenge for the entire industry is the one Henry points out, which is we need something else.
Okay. But in the meantime, and that's what this listener raises, Scott asks, what's the impact of more polls being conducted online? Even the field poll went that way this year for the first time. How does this affect quality?
Well, I think it's a recognition that that we need to come up with something new. The polling is important, again, not just for, you know, kind of forecasting, but also for understanding how people are voting and why, and what's motivating them, what issues they care about, how they think about, you know, the candidates that are before them. And polling is the way to do that, not just looking after the fact at what happened and looking at the vote by geography. So we need polling and we need it to work. The field poll needs it to work. And California needs the field pole and PPIC and others to kind of UC Berkeley that's gotten into it to do well and kind of understand what's happening in the state. And kind of there's a broad recognition that the internet is the answer. As Henry's pointing out, there's no current agreement about how to do that well. What we are presenting at SurveyMonkey is one approach to that. But ultimately, you know, it'll be about, you know, do we agree on kind of how the numbers are created, not just their results. There is a great benefit from general agreement about what makes a high quality survey. And, you know, we're aiming at that.
So then, Ron Elving, how would you sum up where polling is right now? I mean, you're hearing words like turning point from Henry Brady. We're hearing from John Cohen about the challenges that they're still trying to address.
It's in flux, and the demands on the industry are higher than ever. People are practically asking the pollsters to tell them the result of the election. And as we know, that is not a pollster's job. A pollster's job is to gather information, as much information as possible, about as many people as representative of the country as a whole, or the state as a whole, or some particular subgroup as a whole, as possible. And that is a worthy enterprise. It is a worthy commercial enterprise, and that is obviously where most of the money is. And it has played a role in our politics, particularly in giving us more information about the people who vote, such as exit polling. When exit polling is done right and when the samples are representative, it can tell us a great deal, not only about who they were and what their circumstances are, but also what motivated their vote and what they really responded to and what it was in the end that they were trying to say with their vote. And that's enormously valuable to journalists, to scientists, to social scientists, as well as political scientists. It is certainly something we should have, and we want it to work as well as possible. But we should probably stop asking it to conduct our elections for us.
Well, let's go to Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael.
Hello. So in the last few months, I started getting calls from organizations that it seemed by the time I finished answering their questions, it was a push-pull, right, where the organization is asking you a series of questions and they really aren't gathering information for public policy purposes. They're gathering it either to test their messages or to sort of sway my views on subject by asking leading questions. So I started asking them right up front when I would get a call, you know, what is this organization and who is funding you? And they have consistently either given me names that I don't recognize and refused to say who is ultimately funding and say they can't do that. Now, if this was like the Pew Research Center or NBC Washington Post or a legitimate polling organization, do they identify themselves or do they deliberately keep anonymous for some reason?
John Cohen, thanks, Michael.
They absolutely, a legitimate organization will identify itself, and there's a script to do that, and oftentimes there's a callback number if you want to confirm that. But you were absolutely right to ask those questions, and you know, the entire industry depends on, you know, people answering questions, whether it's on the phone or online, and you know, but the pollsters themselves, you know, have a duty to be transparent about why they're doing the work and in some cases who's paying for it.
Well, Gary asks as a follow-up, how do polling companies make money? Who pays them to do these polls? I know it's a broad range, but you know, talk about that a little bit, John Cohen.
Well, it's a big industry, and you know, kind of politics is just a tiny piece of it. Some do political polling for brand recognition. Some do political polling because that is their business. Most polling that happens out there is for market research. So, your listeners, I'm sure, are far more apt to get a call, you know, selling a good or asking them to about a recent car purchase than they are about politics. Although that may not be true in some swing states these days, and I do pity some people who are on the voter rolls with their cell phones now and kind of getting enormous numbers of calls in swing states.
But certainly it's important to know, Ron Elving, who could be funding, right, a polling entity.
You would certainly think you would want to know who was asking you these questions, particularly when they begin to be clearly intending to do something other than find out what you already thought. Something like the notorious push polls in South Carolina in the year 2000 in the Republican primary, where people were asked whether they favored George W. Bush or John McCain. And then if they said John McCain, they were Well, then they were asked a series of leading questions about, did you know this? Did you know that? Would it make a difference to your vote if you knew he had a black child? Things of that nature. Now, that's an egregious case and a famous one. But there have been more subtle push polls that have been effective at getting a certain amount of information or misinformation out about candidates. And so, yes, it seems to me it would be a nice thing to always know who was funding what you are experiencing when you answer a phone call or you go online to participate in a poll.
Well, Ron Elving, if we should not be looking to polls to determine the election for us, what do you think is the healthiest interpretation or relationship that we have with polls? Because we can either go to them as a security blanket or we can go to them to terrify us. What is the, how should we be, you know, keeping it in context?
One value I think the polls do have, insofar as people remain convinced that the polls are legitimate, is that let us say one candidate has been telling the supporters at his rallies, and obviously Donald Trump is the candidate I'm thinking of, that the election is rigged, that the results will not be legitimate, and he will not concede if he loses, and he will not concede necessarily if he loses. He would be more than willing to accept a concession speech from his opponent. Now, if you campaign on that sort of emotion, if you encourage people to think that the vote that they take on November 8th or whenever they vote early is illegitimate or may not be counted properly or maybe in some sense or another messed with by someone, a bureaucrat or a Democrat, what have you, that is going to resonate with a certain number of people. And they are then going to think that if their guy doesn't win, it must have been rigged. It must have been illegitimate. If the polls, including polls from organizations that are clearly not associated with Hillary Clinton or with the Democrats, are showing a consistent lead for her, it lends a certain amount of greater credibility if she does, in fact, win the election. Then people have something else to go on besides just what they hear from the news on the night of the election.
Well, let's go to Robert in San Francisco. I want to get some more calls in here. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. My interest in the polling is more as an analytical tool than in assessing the horse race. And I was particularly interested in how the different polls ask the basic demographic questions of their respondents and how that can or can't be used to make meaningful assessments about all these interesting realignments that seem to be possible within both parties, as we've seen with the Trump campaign and with the Sanders campaign.
Rob,
with respect to the you know, what gets called white working class voters, it's really an assessment of white voters with a high school or less education, which is a very skewed way of, you know, and of looking at working class whites.
Robert, thanks. Let me get John Cohen in.
Yeah, I just want to say, so we're, as I mentioned earlier, polling in all 50 states and releasing stuff every day. And we're doing that not primarily to be right on Election Day, although that would be a nice side benefit. We are doing it to kind of display to everyone out there exactly what you're asking for, Robert. So if you let me one quick plug on surveymonkey.com/elections, we've put up a series of maps that not only show, you know, kind of how it is among likely voters that everyone's obsessing about right now, but those demographic breakdowns that you're talking about. The major differences, you know, between millennials, for instance, and seniors, you know, or among white voters, the critical one between those who have college degrees and those who don't. And what you can see on that map is, you know, kind of a far more powerful thing, you know, than you can get in a simple cross-tabular view of looking at a bunch of numbers. Like this is an important moment in this country. There are big cleavages within the Republican Party as well as within the Democratic one. Some of those are demographic. Some of those are attitudinal. And what we've done in our major polling effort of surveying a million people over the course of the year is to start to display some of that.
And we'll put up a link to that page on our website, I'm being told, so folks can look for that in a little bit. how easy is it, John Cohen, to determine who is a likely voter?
Well, this is a great question. So, you know, all the focus in the last couple of days has been on early voting. And, you know, there have been about 25 million early voters so far. You know, we still have 100 million or so who will come out to vote on Election Day. We don't yet know who those 100 million will be. We have a good sense because there are only 125 or so million possibilities. But it makes a big difference, and it makes a big difference in individual states who actually comes out to vote. So polling in elections is one of the hardest things there is to do because it's not a population that exists yet. It's a future population that we are trying to estimate. So most media organizations just simply ask, are you going to vote, and get your certainty of voting, and then that's it. Most political pollsters, the partisans on both sides who are doing this again and again, are, you know, surveying off the voter lists, and they're making their own probabilistic assessments of who's going to vote. So there are a variety of approaches to it. They're each problematic, but also each helpful.
Well, what do the campaigns do? I mean, I was reading a piece by Jim Messina, who, of course, worked with Obama, and he was talking about how they use these very – and maybe they do use these voter registration rolls. But he was talking about how they use big data, but in a little data way, meaning that they really get granular with all of this data and try all these different variations to try to figure out who the likely voter is going to be. Is that something that – more pollsters or more, you know, polling agencies are doing, or is it just totally cost prohibitive?
Well, there are more and more pollsters who are using the voter lists in states to do their sampling and, you know, kind of making assessments based on, you know, prior votes actually recorded on the rolls in terms of when making those calls. I will say that is not without its own problems, right? There are new registrants that get missed. You know, kind of how counties and states roll up voter lists is imperfect. So there's a lot of adjustments that need to be made. Campaigns with, you know, billion-dollar campaigns have certain assets that individual local pollsters don't have, but each has its own flaws.
Again, we're talking with John Cohen of SurveyMonkey, Henry Brady at the Goldman School at UC Berkeley, and Ron Elving of NPR. Let's go now to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to add to the discussion about what the polls are asking. The caller earlier asked whether a poll that asked if you vote a certain way based on a certain argument was a push poll. I've worked on a lot of campaigns. I'm working on one right now. Actually, most of those are not push polls, at least here in San Francisco and California. They are designed to figure out which arguments work for your issue or against your issue so that you can strategize your campaign. So I think it's actually too expensive to do push polls, as was discussed earlier, because those are so high cost. So I think they're really more informative polls.
And can I ask you a question about funders? If, you know, are you always disclose funders if you're asked?
Absolutely. I mean, the survey companies usually say their company name. I think sometimes the people calling don't actually have the information other than who the company is, and in some cases who the group is. But who, if you're trying to get at who the individuals are funding, you will have to track down who the group is behind it.
Well, John, thanks for making your point. I want to go next to Graciela in Hayward. Hi, Graciela.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning. What's on your mind?
Well, I heard you say earlier how hard it is to reach Latino community. And so I'm a Latina military veteran, mom, business owner. So I represent lots of different demographics. And I want to be asked. I want my voice heard. I want a pollster to call me. So how exactly do we get included in a poll? You know, hasn't anybody really developed a method to figure out who wants to be polled? Because if I have to answer my phone during dinner or when I'm driving my kids to basketball practice, it's not going to happen. So how do we get included, those of us who wish to be counted?
Thanks, Graciela. John Cohen?
I mean, it's a terrific question, and thank you for your willingness to answer, if called. I think the challenge in polling when done in a scientific way is to have it be where the pollster is doing the selection, not the respondents. You don't want to just put up a web link or put up a telephone number to call in, because you will get inevitably a certain kind of person. And that's what, you know, we've seen in these instant reaction polls that many in the media have touted after the presidential debates.
Some in the media have done.
Thank you. Accepted. And, you know, when Donald Trump sends out, like, oh, I've won 7 media polls after each of these debates, those are, you know, opt-in online surveys that just put links up that, you know, get real people directed to them. Or in some cases, it was discovered, you know, bots were programmed to vote a certain way. So there's a grave challenge with self-selection in all kinds of surveys. And so that's the reason why, you know, that's not the general approach.
Well, Graciela, thanks so much for your question. And let's go to David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I was kind of surprised by a few points that I heard. I couldn't keep track of which guests, but made earlier in the program that aren't really supported by data. I mean, the first is that Clinton has a sort of natural electoral advantage relative to the popular vote, which I, from everything I've read, she's much more likely to lose the win the popular vote and lose the electoral college than is Trump. And the second is the idea that the U.S. is less likely to miss on the polls because you have this series of five or six coin flips, whereas Brexit was just one coin flip. And that's just patently false. I mean, if you tell me that Trump wins Wisconsin, Ohio is not a coin flip. So that's all.
Well, David, thanks. Let me give John Cohen a chance to answer that. And at one point, CNN did release today that Hillary Clinton has dropped in their poll below 270 in electoral college votes.
Yeah.
Is that significant?
Well, so let me just answer the college question. I don't know if I was the one who said it earlier or not, but my point wasn't the popular vote relative to the electoral college. I think she has advantages in both, and they're separate. They are related, but they are not equal. And so the advantage of doing state polling, of course, is you don't have to read the tea leaves of a national poll and see how it might play out in the individual state. So that's just one caveat on the question.
And has your survey found Hillary Clinton dipping below 270 as well?
So yeah, we actually in our map that we update every day, she's also below 270 at 262, I believe. But if you give her all the toss up states where she's numerically ahead, she goes back to 328. So that's when I talk about the advantage, she's still advantaged there. And Ohio, the caller mentioned Ohio, and that was of course the key election when it came in 2004. We've had Ohio pretty clearly in Trump's camp the entire campaign. So a Clinton victory certainly doesn't depend on Ohio.
Ron Elving, I mentioned at the top that this is a roller coaster ride. As a news organization, how does NPR decide which polls to report on, right? I mean, for example, this news from CNN, is this something that's going to make it into newscasts, right, at the top of the next hour? Does NPR, how does it basically figure this out?
We have spent a great deal of time talking internally about which polls we think are most legitimate, which ones we think are most responsible, which ones are being conducted by people whose motives are to find accurate information and relay it. We have tried to ignore certainly all of the kinds of polls that we can clearly demonstrate, such as the ones after the immediate snap polls after the debates, that are clearly suspect in the sense that they're subject to all of these forms of manipulation and even robot calling and robot voting. So we do a lot of analysis on these polls, but we also have to report what is the news and what everyone is paying attention to. So even if we had some question in our own minds about whether or not New Hampshire should be taken into the toss-up column, which is what has made the difference for CNN, or even if we were more inclined to give Nevada to Hillary Clinton than CNN, because CNN has done a poll in Nevada that told them that Trump was opening a lead there, we would probably manage to express all of that, but not necessarily in a newscast of 45 seconds. We would put it all online. We would put it all in our stories that will be on our Morning Edition show and on our All Things Considered and on Here and Now. People will hear all of that detail discussed, and they'll hear a criticism of the CNN ORC poll in Nevada that showed Trump opening up a lead. A lot of people see Nevada quite differently. So if you put Nevada back, then the 270 would alter on the CNN map. Ditto with New Hampshire. And we are down to some pretty fine strokes here, aren't we? We're down to just one or two states putting her over or under, mm-hmm. which sounds a lot like 2000 and 2004.
Well, Crystal asked, it appears that most of your guests this morning think Hillary Clinton has a comfortable lead in the polls. Is there a precedent for a dramatic change for the trailing candidate on election day? John Cohen, do you want to take that?
Well, I don't think any of us views the word
comfortable. I knew you were going to say that.
just to be clear.
Not the word.
Yeah. I think that where she sits, it would be rather dramatic and unprecedented to change by Tuesday.
Well, Kelly asks, given the ubiquity of caller ID, are phone polls biased by the profiles of people who answer unknown numbers? Is there a demographic category? that sort of aligns with folks who are more likely
well,
to...
Not all pollsters, and again, I'm not doing telephone polling this cycle, but most telephone pollsters that I work with and actually do have caller ID, and so you know who's calling. Some don't, some do. But, there is certainly you're not getting a purely random look at the population, despite the selection mechanism being one that's tried and true.
Well, Anne has a question about the folks who respond to polls. Anne in Sacramento, good morning.
It was more of a comment, but...
Go ahead.
Yeah, both my husband and I are party not declared, so we do get a lot of phone calls about our opinions. And even though we're party not declared, my husband tends to be more vocally opinionated, and he likes to talk to people. And he's more of a straight ticket voter, I would say, than I am. And so usually when we get those calls, I don't really prefer to, spend the time on the phone, and I just kind of hand him the phone so that he can do it. But, I guess maybe I'm more of a diverse voter than he is also. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, thanks for making the comment. We just have a minute and a half left. Henry Brady, I want to ask you if you could just tell us why polls matter. Why polls matter to an effective democracy?
Well, I think we worry too much about them telling us who's going to win the election, as Ron Elving said earlier. I mean, obviously, we'd all like to know, and it would be great if they could tell us that. But actually, what they really tell us a lot about is who are the people who support particular candidates. So they can tell us who the Trump voters are, for example, who the Clinton voters are, and what their characteristics are. And that's enormously important. And they can also tell us what those people really care about in terms of the issues. And those things are maybe the most important thing polls can do, because in the end, they can help us interpret an election and figure out why it went the way it was and why we, as people in a democracy, may have to think about new policy perspectives or new ways of doing things to deal with the problems that people have out there in the electorate and that they've expressed through their vote.
How concerned are you that large numbers of Americans seem to have lost faith in their democracy, at least according to a SurveyMonkey poll, and we just have seconds, but I'm just curious if you're worried that this could affect, the legitimacy of future data collection?
It's a major concern. I mean, I think the country's political system depends on the losers of one election feeling like they had a fair chance, and then we'll live to fight another day and don't have to continue battling it out every single day.
Well, John Cohen of SurveyMonkey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Henry Brady of UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. And I'd like to thank Ron Elving for joining us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk at NPR News. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.